Welcome to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable, where real people share real stories, and together we crush stigmas one episode at a time. We're coming to you straight from the Rio Grande Valley, located in deep South Texas, the front line of the USA, where Texas meets Mexico, separated by the Rio Grande River. I'm your host, Rico ATP, and riding shotgun is Mr. Did he just say that? Roland Reyes, ATP, and rounding out the team is the Quad Father. We're just two ATPs in a quad with a microphone, a mission, and a whole lot of passion. This podcast is all about real people, real stories, and real power. Lighting life after injury, after technology, and the voices reshaping what it means to roll forward. Buckle up, because at this roundtable, we're not just talking, we're building a movement. How you going, Mr. Roland? How's it going, buddy?
Good. I had a long day.
Yeah, I know you did. And Danny, how are you, bud?
I'm good. Week one over.
Yeah.
I made it. That first week is always tough, back to school, but we made it.
What was the hardest part of the week, man?
It's always the excitement, right, of meeting these kids and seeing what they, you know, getting their vibe. And then we jump right into it. I already had a lab for my biology class. So, you know, it's kind of making sure you kind of walk them through the steps of being careful about lab equipment and making sure they don't hurt themselves and, you know, all these things. And then these kids that are lost, they've never been there on campus, right? So it's tiring in a way that it's kind of stressful because you're doing things that normally throughout the week, I mean, throughout the year, you're not worried about, right? It's just everyone gets in their flow, but that first week, it's just kind of a little chaotic and you just got to, you know, but next week should be a lot smoother. I mean, it feels like that first week's always like 2 weeks long.
The toughest part for me has been the heat. It's been really, really hot here the last few days.
So for our listeners, we are located in the Rio Grande Valley, which is, if you look at a map of Texas and you go straight down, we're right along the coast. I mean, along the coast with South Padre Island, but we're right on the border of
McAllen.
Yeah. So we average, 104 today?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
That's the tough part, getting in and out, going in and out of hospitals and clinics all day today. And that's tough, man.
Well, I mean, not as tough as it is on Danny.
Oh, yeah.
That's a regulated damn temperature.
I have a little fan in my room. I hit that bad boy as soon as because I have an outside campus. If I need to go anywhere, I need to leave my building.
Yeah.
Right. So I got a little fan that as soon as I get back in my room, I got to get myself in that fan and bring my temperature down quickly because not I'm just gonna be cranky.
Yeah. Hey Danny, remind our listeners of where you teach and what your profession is.
So I'm teaching for the PSJA ISD School District, North Raiders, and I teach there as a professor. So I work for them, but I also work for South Texas College down here for all the kids that are working on their, you know, getting their core classes or their associate's degree, which the SDT offers. So I teach the college biology class for them there at the high school.
That's awesome, man. So how's your dating going, man? Are you hitting up any honeys there at school? Any new teachers or
dating coaches? No, but I went against everything that is within me and I put myself on a dating app, unfortunately, just because to try it. I've only been on it like for 3 days. So we'll see. I haven't even really checked it, but at least I got it. I mean, I took a step, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Well, single ladies out there, the Quad Father is now officially available. Well, guys, guess what? We have our first celebrity guest on the show, man. First celebrity guest, man. We have Mr. Philip Bramwell, comedian. Tell me about him, Roland.
He's a comedian and performer born with quadriplegic cerebral palsy. His early life included adaptive wheelchair sports, professional acting and modeling, medical procedures, and even a creative exploration of drumming. Today, he blends humor with lived experience to offer a unique perspective on disability and dependence in everyday life. Outside of comedy, Philip enjoys travel, attending live shows, and building meaningful relationships. He believes strongly in the power of education and the value of earning a living through the skills developed by navigating life with a disability. His work reflects a commitment to independent self-worth and contributing to the lives of family, friends, and his future spouse and children. Philip approaches comedy not just as entertainment, but as a platform for connection, understanding, and impact. Hello, Philip. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you guys for having me, and I look forward to speaking with your audience. Thank you for tuning in.
Awesome, my friend. Tell us about yourself, man. Take us to the beginning and just walk us through your story.
So I'm 27 years old, originally from New Jersey. Right now I live in Tempe, Arizona. I was born in New Jersey. I'm a triplet, so that means we're all the same age. No, the other two don't have a cerebral palsy or anything else wrong with them. We were born 3 months early. You're supposed to make it 9 months about, but we made it about six. And so we were premature. That's the term. And so I have cerebral palsy, which is a brain injury caused by bleeding. And so they resolve the bleeding, you know, so you can survive, but the damage is done, if you will. So I'm in a manual wheelchair. I have a moderate speech impediment. Most people can understand me. And I have a impairment in four limbs, both arms and both legs. So my arms work okay, but not that great, but good enough to get through. And so that's a bit about me. And then, of course, it's deeper than that, but that was my early life.
Got you. So what type of equipment did you get started with? Was it early intervention, like going into elementary, into maybe first, second grade?
That's a great question. So in my early life with cerebral palsy, you know, some people can walk, you know, with mobility devices. Some people can walk, you know, without anything and with their gait, you know, just limping around, or some people can't walk at all. So in my early years, you know, people, you know, in therapy, they would try to make me walk or try to see if I could walk. I did some limping around when I was a kid with the use of a posterior walker. So that's a walker that comes from behind. I also did cane walking, so with full canes. But the problem is with my severity of brain injury, I don't have any balance. So if I let go of, you know, something to hold on to, then my ass is on the ground. So that pretty much eliminates the possibility of walking for me if I want to be independent. So that's why I transitioned to manual wheelchair when I was about 10 years old.
10 years old? What kind of wheelchair did you have? Do you remember the make and model or details on it?
When I was a kid, I had, you know, more insurance because my parents, you know, they got insurance through their employment. So I had Tie Light wheelchairs when I was a kid. They were pretty good. My first wheelchair was the worst one, as it is for everyone, because basically they just give you everything, you know, the headrest and the side guards and the lateral things that poke up in your armpits and all that shit.
It sounds so, like you had a tilt in space.
Yeah, the first one was the worst one, but they've gotten better after that, and I think I'm in a pretty good flow.
You consider using any motorized wheelchair?
That's a good question. I've not considered using a motorized wheelchair. Partially, that's because insurance will only pay for a manual or an electric wheelchair, but not both. So that's one reason. And then the second reason is my upper body was, you know, good. Not good, but good enough. So, you know, I've been fine so far with a manual wheelchair. And I'm going to do that until the wheels fall off, if you will.
How effective are you with self-propulsion?
I can push myself, you know, to an outsider, you know, someone that's not familiar with disability. You know, I get asked if I need help in public very often. And I know people mean well, but it's because I look like I'm struggling. I mean, I am struggling. If I wasn't struggling, I would be, you know, able-bodied. So yeah, I'm struggling, but you know, I gotta keep whatever strength I have. And so that's a mindset that I think if you're not disabled, you don't understand. Like, why don't they just take help every time? You know, we have to maintain whatever strength and flexibility that we have. And so that means we can't accept help every time somebody asks us. And so that's a summary of that question.
Gotcha. Hey, Danny, can you add on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with what he said. Like, people ask all the time, and I appreciate that they ask, right? And keep asking, right? But there will be times, right? There's times where it's like, you know what? I just can't do it. There had been times where I just couldn't go up a ramp, or I couldn't do a certain thing, right? And if somebody's around to help me and they ask, and I've even gone up to people and said, you know what? Hey, sorry to interrupt, but this thing is just a little bit too hard for me to get up on, right? And they'll help me, right? I think most people are pretty cool about helping you if you need it. And like I said, I appreciate that they ask. Most times I'm just like, no, thank you very much for asking, but I'm good, right? I'm struggling, but I'm good, just like Philip said. But, you know, there are times where, you know, it's way too hot outside, or there's, you know, the terrain is a little bit bad or whatever, right? And yeah, I'm gonna have somebody ask. Definitely.
Is there a certain way that that could, how can I say this, to be approached? Or are there certain ways that you guys are approached that is kind of like, man, it's just a turn off versus a help? Has anything ever happened like that?
Go ahead, Philip. I'm not.
Well, I can answer that. My main issue with people asking me if I need help is because I've been asked if I need help so much since I was a kid. I can't even name the amount of times. It's been thousands of times. You know, I've had difficulty, you know, making friends, and of course with dating as well. And so it can be difficult to tell if someone's asking me if I need help. Is that their social icebreaker, or are they really asking me if I need help? Then if I decline the help, it doesn't mean that I'm not interested in socializing. It just means that I'm not interested in having help in that moment. It happens a lot. Interestingly, I get asked if I need help a lot when I'm exercising. And, you know, I don't think it really registers with a lot of people that if people help us exercise, for example, if they lift the weights for us or if they push us while we're doing our cardio, then we're no longer exercising. They're doing it for us, right? So I don't want to say conflict, that's the wrong word, but I definitely feel internally difficult about that situation because it happens quite often.
Danny?
I, you know, it's funny, now that I think about it, what I get asked most if I need help is when I'm in or getting in or around my vehicle. For some reason, I'll get it randomly, you know, and then people open the doors and stuff like that, that's normal. But like the one time I do get asked often, and it never fails, is when I'm getting out of my vehicle or into my vehicle, more into my vehicle. I think people don't know. There's like, well, this guy's driving. Like, what does he need help getting in? Like, how does he getting in? Right. And I think it throws people for a loop sometimes. And so I find that most often, yes, it's when I'm driving. And back when I used to like go to the gym, now I work out here, but yeah, you're right. Whenever I'd be at the gym, it was kind of weird. Like, it's kind of a weird dynamic for the help, right? Like, I got this, but I don't, like, you know what I mean? It's a weird thing.
Philip, you've done some professional acting and modeling. Tell us how you got started on that and how old you were. And tell us a little bit about what that was like, especially with quadriplegic cerebral palsy.
Absolutely. So the way that I started professional acting and modeling is when I was about 7 years old, there used to be a show on Disney Channel. It's called The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. And they had an episode that featured wheelchair basketball. And the gentleman that was in the show, I looked him up and he was genuinely disabled. So they didn't just put his ass in a wheelchair, you know, to fulfill the role. He was actually paralyzed. And I believe it was a car accident. Don't quote me on that. But anyway, he was in a wheelchair. And when I was about 7 years old, I didn't know shit of what I could do with my life because I was born in the late 90s and there was limited technology in the first 10 years of my life. So it wasn't like anybody had any idea what the hell I could do. And nobody really had any suggestions other than, you know, asking if I'm eligible for Social Security. You know, it just looked like a shit show, basically. So when I watched this episode, you know, I had this epiphany that, hey, that guy is in a wheelchair. I'm in a wheelchair. He's acting, you know, why not? Why not? I should give that a go. So I asked my mom and if I could be in professional acting. I told her I saw this episode. I asked her, you know, how do they get on the show like that? And, you know, and then it took off from there.
So what was your first role?
I think Roland's first gig.
I think Roland saw an episode last night.
Yeah, I saw as we were talking pre-show, I saw season 20, episode 4 of Law and Order, the original Law and Order, not any of the other,
yeah,
with the acronyms. But yeah, I saw his scene. He has a speaking scene and he speaks. He's being not interrogated. He's being interviewed by one of the detectives.
Stabler.
No. One of the younger guys, Sisto. And it was interesting. It was really interesting, Philip. And you did a really, really good job.
Well, thank you so much. So to answer that question, my first professional role was I was in Sesame Street. So that was filmed in Connecticut. And so that was my first role as a child actor. I was, I think, seven and a half or 8 years old. And that was my first role. Then I had a few others. But as we know, there isn't a lot of wheelchair, you know, acting roles. And so, you know, it wasn't like I got a lot of work, but I did get good quality work when I was able to get it. So it was a very enjoyable experience.
And how long did your career last as far as a child actor?
My career like ended at any point.
Right.
A child actor, you just stop getting work because you're in a fucking wheelchair and there's not a lot of wheelchair roles.
So it just slowed the trickle to a trickle.
Yeah, it just slowed down. And then when I got to like a grown up, like 17, 18, I was like, oh shit, I gotta make money. So, you know, I just went traditional route. I went to college. I went to University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, graduated with a bachelor degree in journalism. And, you know, kind of not that I quit acting, but, you know, acting quit me, if you will. And I'm still interested. I still train here and there. And, you know, the door is always open on my end. It's just a matter of, is it open on the other side?
Right. Well said. Philip, I've always been curious. How does it acting work? Do they put you in a scene? I just think like action. That's all I know about movies. So what goes into preparing you for a scene?
Well, we get our sides. It's called sides, the script. We get that weeks in advance, 3 or 4 weeks in advance. And so we're expected to practice and be already fully memorized by the day of the filming. And we film the scene. Probably takes at least an hour at minimum to film. And at the most, we filmed for like 4 hours for one of the scenes. And professional acting is very serious, even for children, because we're under contract with our representation, our agent. So if we do a shitty job, then not only would we get in trouble with the production company that we were filming with, but we also would get in trouble with, you know, our representation. And we're professional actors, so we're getting paid. So it was very serious. And so everybody, even as a child, we were approached in a very serious manner. So I always made sure to be prepared. And I was in professional acting classes soon after that episode aired of Suite Life of Zack and Cody. And I'm very grateful that my parents invested in me in that way.
Yes, amazing.
Philip, do you have a certain technique that you get ready before you start recording? Is there something you have? I mean, it's very serious, like you said. So, well, how do you prepare for that? I mean, it's such a young age having all that pressure on you.
That's a good question. Well, the way my mindset when I was a kid was, as far as I could tell, even though it's not always good to compare yourself to other disabled kids, you know, I kind of did because, you know, who doesn't? And I just looked around and I was like, wow, being disabled is a real shit show for the most part. And I kind of viewed acting and modeling as not my escape from being disabled, but, you know, I saw that I could get paid the same amount of money as a normal able-bodied person and get treated with more respect. And so you're bringing up the question about pressure. You know, I didn't really feel any pressure. I thought that was my escape from the hellhole that being disabled can be.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I was always happy to practice my lines, or always happy to, you know, talk to my agent, or always happy to go, you know, film an audition or film a recording of that episode. You know, I always viewed it as my life was going to get better from doing it. So there was no pressure at all.
Nice. It sounds like you were treated like an adult actor, treated like everyone else. Was there any special accommodations that had to be made for you on set?
That's a good question. Separate from being disabled, all child actors, whether you're able-bodied or disabled, all children actors get treated like adults. So that's probably the only area in society where there's no difference between children and adults. And so it's the ultimate equal opportunity.
Right.
And then you ask about accommodations. There wasn't accommodations for being disabled, I would say. It's just you don't get selected for, you don't get offered auditions as often, and you don't get selected as often. But it's not really accommodations. You just simply don't get picked.
I see.
And so you get the projects you do get picked for, you don't need accommodations because you only got picked because you didn't need accommodations. Got I don't it. Know if that makes sense, but
yes, sir.
All
yes,
I'm
sir.
Trying to say is no, there's no accommodations. It's the ultimate equal opportunity.
Wonderful.
Hey, Philip, you brought up an important point about while you were acting, you know, that shit show was, you know, you weren't in it, right? And it I think it's something that rings kind of with a lot of people with a disability. Like me, myself, I feel that whenever I'm working, right? Like I'm doing this thing that, and the wheelchair thing, the disability thing, you know, all that shit that we deal with is gone, right? Where you're kind of in your element, right? And I don't, you know, I don't feel that. And, you know, you said it like during the summers when I'm not working, I do feel that. Like, it's like, I'm just here, I'm in my chair, kind of not doing anything. And that's all I'm thinking about. Is that something that, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, that you feel the same as well?
Well, at this point in my life, you know, I'm not really, you know, I don't really separate work from no work. My mindset is the same either way. When I was a kid, I did enjoy my life more when I was an actor compared to when I wasn't. But sometimes that isn't always the healthiest mindset. It can become a kind of like a drug where you're in a fantasy so often that you don't
that makes sense.
Enjoy or appreciate your reality. So I wouldn't advise anyone to absorb that mindset. But yeah, when I was a kid, maybe it was true a little bit that I did enjoy my life as a child actor compared to my normal life. But that was also because when I was a kid, when I was a child actor, people would treat me better. When they found out I was a child actor, people would treat me better than when I was just a Philip in a wheelchair. Even the rest of society treated me better when they heard I was a professional actor. So yeah. I did enjoy that part of it because there was a noticeable difference in the way that adults and my fellow children treated me when I was a kid.
So far, what's your favorite role you played and what show was that?
My favorite role was I was in an HBO pilot. Unfortunately, that it didn't get picked up by the network, but we did film it. That was pretty cool. If it would have got picked up, it would have changed my life because I was already under contract to be in the cast. But unfortunately, the network didn't pick up the script.
And so none of that is available right now to watch? Or
no, it kind of vanished. I don't know the politics of what happened, but it didn't get picked up. We filmed the pilot and then the network didn't pick it up, and that was the end of that.
So tell us about the show. Now you have me interested.
Yeah, curious.
It was a long time ago, so I don't remember the complete details.
Oh, okay.
But it was for a prominent network that I'm going to not name because who knows if I'll be working with them, you know, somewhat right. in the
True.
Future.
Smart.
But anyway, it was a long time ago. I know that was not the best answer, but it was filmed when I was about 11 years old.
Okay.
And I mentioned that one because if it did get picked up, it would have changed my life. I would have been a full-time child actor. You know, child actors, they get pulled out of public school and your private school, you know, like right. basically one-on-one tutors. So it would have changed the trajectory of my entire life. That's why I bring it up.
Wow. All right. What first drew you to comedy, Philip, and how do you use humor to share your lived experiences?
Absolutely. I mentioned that I had, toward the end of my childhood, teenager life, I decided to transition to, you know, more mainstream, go to college, get a normal job. And so I finished my bachelor's degree and then I worked in customer service for about 4 years and my entire department was laid off. And so when this layoff happened, it opened up my time. And of course, getting a job with a disability is difficult. So I decided to work on comedy because that's something where I had the skill set and I had control over the outcome of my trajectory, if you will. And so that's how I transitioned to comedy. It's because I lost my job, my 9-to-5, and it opened up my time. I always thought about doing comedy, but when I was in the mindset that I had to just be a normal 9-to-5 wheelchair guy, you know, I kind of put my creativity to the side. But I'm so grateful to be back in the game, and I don't plan on leaving anytime soon.
Hey, Philip, speaking of comedy, right? Do you find it? I know because, you know, you were born with a disability, right? I didn't get hurt till 27. And one thing I noticed, and maybe you've noticed this as well, is whenever you're around, say, family or maybe some friends, for me coming back, it was a kind of a shock for a lot of people. They hadn't seen me, right? I was away for 4 months and I'm back in a wheelchair, right? And whenever you make new friends or meet new people, right, they don't know how to act a little bit around you. And what I found that helps me, and I'm not sure if you do the same thing, but I try to, you know, make fun of the situation in some sort of way just to kind of help them to relax, you know, because when I used to move around, it's like, you know, what do I do? Are you okay? Or this and that, right? And I have a feeling that in my experience, a lot of people kind of, you know, they don't know what to do, especially people that we know. What do you do in those situations? Like I said, I use humor. Is that something you do, or you just tell them straight up? What do you do?
That's a great question. So an important factor in my answer is that I was born disabled. So I was a wheelchair baby, then a wheelchair toddler, then a wheelchair kid, right? So when you're a kid, usually in society, you wait for the adult to speak first. But usually when I was a kid, one of the first adult behaviors I learned was to be proactive, to be the one that says hello first, to introduce myself first, because I always observed around me that wheelchair kids and disability kids, you know, had stigma. And it's even worse if you have a speech difficulty, which I have the speech impediment now, but it was worse when I was a kid because my teeth were all fucked up. So it was worse when I was a kid. So I just understood that I had to talk first. Otherwise, people would think I was retarded. So I had to just be proactive. And that's what I would advise anybody, no matter what age you are.
Amazing.
Do you, whenever you're doing comedy, or I mean, maybe it's not just comedy, but do you use that to kind of educate people at times? How is it that you get, you know, the word out and say, hey, look, these are things that we go through, whatever it is, right? Is that something that you include in your comedy?
Right. I view comedy as a vehicle for education and advocacy. But as a comedian, it's always an entertainment first mindset. I'm primarily there to entertain. If you pick up something educational from it, that's great. But in the context of comedy, I'm there to entertain. Of course, I do more academic talks as well. You know, sometimes when you're too academic, you lose a certain audience. So, you know, because I'm a professional comedian, you know, you can't alienate or lose the entertainment factor. So when I do comedy, although it's a vehicle for advocacy, my mindset is I'm primarily there for entertainment because that's what everyone else signed up for.
Right.
Philip.
Go ahead, Rico.
How do you come up with your material? I mean, how do you come up with a bit? Is it just something you're just brainstorming, or is it something that you see on TV? I know certain comedians have like a book they write their bits on and they'll touch on it later. How does that work for you?
Well, for me, I base my material off of my real life. And so it's not that difficult to come up with a premise. A premise is the term we use for just the idea of the joke. The difficulty, if you will, is how do you turn, you know, an ordinary idea into something that's funny, that's engaging, and then an extra thing that you have to overcome as a disability comic is most of your audience is not disabled or they don't have experience with disability. So you can't, you know, use terminology that's, you know, that they've never heard of, or you don't want them to, you know, feel bad. You know, it has to be of a positive nature. And so that's an extra layer of creativity that a wheelchair comic or a disability comic has to have. And I think I do a great job with that. And I think that's why people connect with me, even though they're not familiar with disability a lot of the time.
Gotcha. Is your show what? 5-10 minutes? What is, how long are you at?
Well, every time you get booked somewhere, the amount of time you get varies depending on the needs of the producer and who else is on the show. So I've done 5-minute shows, 10-minute shows, and 15-minute shows.
Nice.
Everybody wants to get as long on stage as possible. But, you know, we take what is available and what somebody is willing to give us, because, you know, a producer gets to decide the ultimate order. You know, we're independent contractors as comedians. So we're getting hired one at a time by each producer that chooses to hire us.
Gotcha. So how are you as far as reading the audience? I mean, is your show already set up in a certain structure, like I'm going to go here, here, and here? Or do you, let's say you start off a show and you get some kind of vibe, like, okay, they're not getting it. Do you mix it up? I mean, I think that would be kind of the one thing I would be worried about, is losing the audience.
That's a good question. So I think all comedians adjust their material slightly based on the audience, but we can't give away the secret. Otherwise, you know, then the secret is out. So I'm going to just leave it there on that question.
I have a question. I'm thinking, what would I, you know, I could never do that, but what would I need? I'm thinking about the space, right? What do you need to do the work, right? I'm sure you need some space. I would like the mic thing. Would that be attached? Is that attached to your wheelchair? Right? There better be a freaking ramp there. What are some of the basic requirements for you in order to do your show, right? Like some basic needs, right? I'm assuming it's slightly different than everyone else.
That's a good question. Actually, to be honest, it's the same as everyone else. That's one of the reasons why I love comedy. That's one of the reasons why I love acting and entertainment, because the entertainment industry does not give a shit about your disability. When I say they don't give a shit about your disability, that's in good ways and in bad ways. Like, if you're shit at comedy, you know, people are gonna tell you about it. But if you're good at comedy, you'll get the same opportunities as everyone else. So that's the ultimate equal opportunity. One of the things I noticed about the disabled community is, of course, we want equal opportunities in good ways. But if we want the equal opportunities in good ways, then we have to accept the equal opportunity in the bad ways too. You know, if you want to be, you have to accept that somebody is also gonna critique. You know, it's a balanced approach, and that's something that you have to accept as a entertainer and definitely as a disabled person.
That's very interesting.
Nice. Yesterday when we were talking, you made a comment that you know got my attention. So you said, be your own unique comedian. And that got my attention. Can you explain that?
Yes, that's a good question. So I believe that one of the reasons comedians struggle is they try to be like someone else, most likely a comedian that's already famous or already known. And, you know, I've noticed that it's very difficult to do someone else's jokes or even their premises better than the original. So, you know, I just try to be Wheelchair Philip. And as long as I'm Wheelchair Philip and I stay true to myself and my brand, then I'll have a better chance to get a bigger and better opportunity.
How many days out of the month do you travel for gigs?
It varies by who is willing to hire me. Right now, I live in Arizona, so most of my shows are in Arizona, but I'm a full-time comic, so whoever's hiring, you know, I'll consider being there. There's some steps that have to happen, so maybe we'll talk about that, but, you know, it's not like a magic wand where you're in Alaska, you know, instantly or anything like that, but in a sense, I'm available to go wherever hires me.
You know, where you go or anywhere you go, do you prefer, because traveling is tough, do you prefer like the drive there or flying there? Because it's two different worlds and two very different ways of getting there and things that you need, right? What is your preferred way of travel? Because it has been a while since I've traveled. What's your best way of getting wherever you need to get?
That's a good question. So in general, a disabled person, there are people that can drive. But with my severity or impairment, I'm not able to drive. So by default, that makes my default traveling via airplane. And so that's usually how I get places. Even short distances, I travel by airplane because driving is not an option for me.
I don't know if it's still true, but when I first got hurt, they used to say, if you're in a wheelchair, you're first on, but last off. Is that still the thing?
Yes, that's correct. So they load a wheelchair our disability person on the plane first by putting us on an aisle chair. And then in a plane, the aisles are very thin. So they have to sardine us onto the plane. And then way out, they let everyone else off first. And we spend on average an extra hour to 2 hours on a plane compared to everyone else. So let's say your flight time is 5 hours. You're going to be on the plane for 6 to 7 hours if you're in need of an aisle chair.
If anyone is here listening, right, I think if I remember correctly, so you can request when you're calling in to get your flight, what you want to tell them, especially if you're in a wheelchair, say, look, I'm in a wheelchair, and you can request with it. I think it's called a bulkhead seat, which is usually in the front or in the aisle. That way they can reserve that seat for you. I think that's how it still works. Again, it's been a while since I've been on a plane, but if I remember correctly, I think that's how they explain it. So anybody that wants to do that, you do have that opportunity to get that specific chair in the front. You know, especially in my case, I kick a lot, so I don't want to be seated anywhere else, right? Like, I don't want to be behind somebody. So that's something that, you know, people that are wanting to travel should consider.
Philip, how do you balance humor with serious realities of living with a disability?
Well, as a comedian, the job is to be funny. So, you know, it's my job, and my job is to be funny. So just like a normal person, you know, with a job, you know, you leave your personal problems at the door. And when I'm doing comedy or preparing for comedy, I'm at work. So just like anyone else, you got to learn to decompartmentalize and not allow one to affect the other.
Okay. Well, touching on that, so how do you balance humor with the serious realities of living with a disability?
Well, the serious realities, I was born with my condition, so
gotcha.
I think those kind of emotions and those difficulties, I think those were addressed early in my life. So now gotcha. It's pretty normal to be disabled. Well, my version of normal. And so, like, I don't really think too much like, oh, fuck, I'm in a wheelchair, or, man, I might fall on the ground and all that shit, because that already happened to me so many times. You know, you just get used to it, and you learn to stay focused on what needs to happen and what my goals are.
Do you typically travel alone?
Yes, I travel alone. Not particularly because I want to. It's because right now I don't have any friends that want to travel with me. And then traveling, you know, with a PCA, or that's personal care attendant, you know, then I have to pay all their expenses. So yeah, I'm traveling alone for now, but that's not particularly because I want to. I can travel alone, but I don't want to necessarily.
Right. Do you make your own arrangements, your own, you schedule your own gigs?
Yeah. How does that work?
Well, once you become a better known comedian, people hire an agent, and that's done for you, all the back end work. But for now, I do all that. So I'm my manager, I'm my travel agent, I'm my whatever you can think of. It's a one man show right now.
Yeah, that's the way it starts.
That's kind of how we have it. How Rico and I work down here, where ATP is working on wheelchairs and selling wheelchairs. And yeah, we do everything. We've in the past been spoiled with having a CSR to assist us and a technician to assist us. And here we kind of do everything. So I kind of make our own phone calls, make our own scheduling. And yeah, we book our own evaluations.
We're with you, Philip.
A one-man wrecking crew.
Yeah.
Yep. It's October of 2024 at the Tempe Improv. That was your first show. You had, 150 people there?
Yes, it was about 150.
How'd that go?
Yeah, tell me about that day. Like, from when you got up, this is my first time on stage. I'm going to get some real good support. What was that like for you, man?
Well, it was my first time on stage in the sense of comedy, but not my first time on stage in general. So I think that's one of the reasons why it went, you know, relatively smooth or better than you would expect for my first time. But I was happy to be there, and you know, I was in the right headspace. You know, I understood that I'm there to entertain the crowd. The show is not about me. I mean, I'm the one facilitating, but the show is never about me. The show is about making sure that the audience has a memorable time, and that when they leave the venue, that when they tell their friends and family about, hey, what'd you do on that Friday or that Wednesday? And they have something positive to say, and that they say, positive feedback, hopefully, about me. So, you know, I always had that mindset that it's not about me. And that's what helped me be successful that night. And I remain with that same mindset.
Do you have any jokes in your back pocket? Like when you were doing that first show in Tempe, do you have that one joke you just wanted to, that you were just holding on to? It's like, when I say this one, I'm going to get them good. Did you have that?
Well, everything is a certain, you know, strategy to it.
Right.
But again, I don't want to discuss further because
I know, I got you.
The magic would be gone.
I got you.
How's that?
Here, I got a question.
Go for it, Dan.
In your experience, right, what are some misconceptions that you've kind of run into when it comes to life with a disability, right? Some things that, you know, people just tend to get wrong or whatever.
That's a good question. Honestly, I don't pay too much attention to the misconceptions because there's 8 billion people in the world. So I don't want to, you know, pay too much attention to everybody's misconception. I just kind of focus on being, you know, the best version of myself. And then if I am the best version of myself, you know, my opportunities can come, even if they're going to be difficult. But one thing that comes with disability that we all know, especially if you're born with it, is it's pretty much a shit show a lot of the time. And so not that it's easy to have a shit show, but at least we're used to it. And, you know, we know how to navigate various different issues.
How do you usually deal? You know, there's going to be those bad days, right? We all have them, right? What is your kind of go-to just to kind of, you know what, take your step back? What do you do to get past that?
I think it's the same as when I was a kid, you know, when comedy, it's my avenue to improve my finances, my avenue to improve my dating life, my avenue to improve my regular friend life. You know, comedy is my holistic wellness to improve all the shit show parts of my life. So, you know, I think that's the medicine for anybody. You know, everybody knows that there's a lot of shit when you're disabled, but you got to find a path that can at least give you a fighting chance to resolve whatever is bothering you or whatever problems you have.
Oh, very true.
Philip, how important are relationships to you, like your family, your friends, or future goals in shaping the person you are today?
Absolutely. So if I'm honest, my parents are divorced. They got divorced when we were 3, so relatively young. But I would say that divorce has a lot of negative effects on children. One of the negative effects is that you don't value family as much, to be honest. And you find flaw in your family in some ways because you're parents, which are supposed to be the glue, they find flaw in each other. So it can be difficult to remain fully connected with family members. But I do value my family. It's just not the same as, if your parents get along. But, you know, I have my own appreciation for each member of my family. And I've learned to separate, everyone's opinion of each other.
I was going to say, earlier you brought up, I'm talking about relationship here. You brought up dating life. What's your approach? How do you go about it? Luck, bad luck? Just what's going on there? I could go tips. On about my, I know. Give me some tips, man. Help me out here.
Come on, Philip. Help him out, brother.
Well, I usually, right now I go to speed dating events.
Okay.
Interesting.
And so that's my approach with dating. But pretty much anytime I'm interested in a woman, you know, I'm not scared or, you know, I'm not a bitch. You know, I ask, you know, a woman out if I want to. And, you know, I think being a child actor and being a comedian, that helps a lot. You know, you got to have balls to be confidence. An actor. You got to have balls to be a comedian. So dating is just another area in life where you got to have your balls. So even if you can't feel your balls, you got to have your balls.
Dude, where do you put your balls when you're sitting all day? Where do you place your balls, man? You got like an extra cushion for the balls? What the hell?
I've had a lot of ball injuries, to be honest. From the level of risk and the courage I've had to have to make my life more appealing, because the baseline level of being disabled is a shit show, you know, broke, lonely, unhealthy. You know, we have to really bust our ass to make our life more appealing, you know. But I like the saying that, you know, life is a canvas and we get to paint it, you know, the way that we want it. So I try to remember that I have control over certain things and I have to control whatever I can.
Amazing. Very well true. Said. All right, Philip. Got anything for him, Roland?
No, it's an amazing interview.
Yep. Danny?
No, man. I'm gonna get out there, Philip. Damn it. There was a speed dating here in Edinburgh a couple weeks ago.
Really?
And I really thought about it. I was thinking. I was like, I don't know, man. So I just kind of didn't do it. But next time, for sure, it's on.
Philip says you have to have balls, Danny.
Balls.
I'm going to work on the balls.
I'm going to make shirts and put them out there.
Balls. Balls.
I think one thing as a disabled, particularly as a disabled man with a disability, you have to understand that most women are not going to want to date us initially. We're going to convert a no to a yes most of the time. But their initial reaction is going to be like, no, I don't want to deal with that paralyzed dude or that dude with the headrest or, you know, whatever the hell. His arm is fucked up. You know, there's plenty of healthy dudes that we have. So we have that extra barrier, but we can overcome that by, you know, making sure that we're marketable, that we have social skills, that we have hygiene, and that we know what the hell we're doing. I like to use the term professional disabled person.
I got a final question for you, Philip. How would you describe your comedy style?
Well, I mentioned that I talk about my genuine life. So I think that's a start. And then I do have a particular, you know, persona or, you know, a stage presence. But again, not to repeat the same, but I don't want to give too much away because if you come and see me, you can decide for
find
yourself.
Out. You can find out. Where can we see you? Where can people see you today or anytime soon?
My next show is Wednesday, September 3rd at Tempe Improv. That's 930 East University Drive, Tempe, Arizona. And the show might be already done by the time this episode is out. I'm not sure. But to follow, I don't know if I'm supposed to pitch my...
Yeah, sure. 100%.
This is for you, buddy.
You can follow me on Instagram, Wheelchair Philip. So that's wheelchair, like the device. Wheel and chair is one word. And then Philip is PHILLIP, Wheelchair Philip. That's on Instagram, YouTube. And I'm also on another platform called Fourth Star. And Fourth Star is a virtual reality platform. And I do have a promo code affiliate link. They'll probably add it in the show notes. And so those are the three ways that you can... You can follow me, and also my Venmo, they'll probably have it in the show notes. Comedy is my job. So if you see a clip that you like and you want to support me, I would appreciate and do appreciate any tips because, you know, there's associated expenses and time that goes into providing a professionally sound experience. And I do appreciate anybody that is willing to contribute.
Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Philip. Danny, do you have anything?
No, man. That was awesome. I enjoyed
That's
this.
That's amazing.
Philip, it's been awesome meeting you. I want to turn on my camera so I can officially say hi in a bit, but we'll wait till we're done.
All right. Mr. Philip Bramwell, it's a pleasure to meet you. And you always have a seat here at the roundtable, my friend.
Thank you so
much. We wish you all the success in the world, Philip.
We're going to support you, brother. We'll be talking about you on the show, and we see you on social media. We're going to be plugging for you.
Yeah, I'm going to share you every time I can come up to a video, and I'll share it for you.
Yeah, we need you here in Texas, man. Come visit us.
Absolutely. I'll be anywhere and everywhere. But thank you so much, fellas, for having me. And thank you to our audience. Thank you for tuning in, for listening to what we have to say. And I look forward to seeing you at a show sometime.
All right.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable. We'll be seeing you soon. Bye.